Okay, so today I'm going to be talking about asymmetric Hawking radiation. In particular, I'm going to be talking about ways to make a black hole emit more, in this case, baryon number or lepton number, than antibaryon or antilepton numbers. So basically, more electrons than antipositrons, more neutrinos than antineutrinos. So the general structure of the talk is going to be I'll give some sort of brief motivation, talk about the general idea. I'll go through the actual ingredients needed to make the story work, and then I'll sort of pedagogically apply this idea of asymmetric Hawking radiation to black holes before and after inflation, and just to reproduce the observed baryon number asymmetry. Okay. So, sort of the motivation is we look around us, we see a universe that's full of matter, but not antimatter. And so we have some net excess of baryon number, and we would like to explain this. So, what people thought about in the past originally was, well, this is an arbitrary initial condition, we don't need it. And then we discovered that we needed inflation to solve things like the horizon problem. And so the exponential expansion of the universe just sort of inflates away any original symmetry. So what we really have to do is start with some state that has no baryon number and generate it. And so the first thing people did was they formulated various conditions needed to actually generate baryon number. And so the most famous ones are Sakharov's conditions, which are roughly you need C and
There is
C.
some historical anachronism in the way you describe it, because
Yeah.
inflation came much later than Sakharov's.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And in fact, even Sakharov's conditions, people sort of ignored for a long time because they just missed this paper. And then afterwards, when they had sort of rediscovered a lot of these things, they looked back and, like, oh, actually, he had thought about it before all of us. And yeah.
That's the Russian did its first theorem.
Yeah. Yep. And so what Sakharov had said you needed was you need C and CP violation. This is just because you need to somehow break the symmetry between particles and antiparticles. And so basically, every single model of baryogenesis that I know of has that condition. You have B minus L violation because you basically start with a system that has no baryon number and you need to generate it. I'm just as a note, I'm specifying B minus L violation versus baryon or lepton number because in the standard model, B minus L is the anomaly-free symmetry. And the last one is you need to leave thermal equilibrium somehow because basically nothing ever happens in thermal equilibrium. You have detailed balance, the rates going forward and backwards are the same. And particles and antiparticles are there in the same abundance, and so you have no charge. Okay, so very briefly, some of the popular mechanisms that people have talked about are, well, there's first electroweak baryogenesis. This is the idea that you don't generate a net B minus L, but you generate a net B plus L. And so what you do is you basically say that there is you create a spatial asymmetry when the electroweak bubbles form. And so there's inside there are electroweak sphalerons taking your B plus L and relaxing it to zero, and outside you don't. And so interactions across the wall of this bubble can generate a net B plus L asymmetry. So this doesn't actually work in the standard model, but if you, given the current measured value of the Higgs mass, but you can extend the standard model to make this mechanism work. There's also the standout freeze-out and decay, which is just the gut way of doing baryogenesis. You have some particle, it freezes out, and then its CP violating decays generate you V minus L asymmetry. There's things like Dirac leptogenesis and all of its ilk, whose basic idea was saying, well, now not generate a net B or a net B minus L, but you just sort of separate it into two sectors that are decoupled from each other. So they originally considered right-handed neutrinos and just giving them a Dirac mass, and they turn out not to be coupled with the rest of the standard model. And since then, people have extended it to include things like dark matter or whatever your favorite extra sector is. People have also done Affleck-Dyne baryogenesis. So this is just using coherent scalar excitations. And then finally, a not too well-known mechanism called spontaneous baryogenesis, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail, just because it's the most similar mechanism to what I'm going to be talking about. And so what spontaneous baryogenesis did was look at this out of thermal equilibrium condition and say, well, actually, this is not a problem, because what if in thermal equilibrium there exists a B minus L ace symmetry? And so thinking back to statistical mechanics, this is actually a fairly common thing. What happens is if the particles and antiparticles have unequal energy levels, then they have different abundances. And so this is achieved by a chemical potential. So when you apply a chemical potential to a thermal system, what happens is the thermal equilibrium carries B minus, carries some charge. So the way the chemical potentials work is you add to your Hamiltonian mu times your charge. And so this splits the energy levels of particles and antiparticles because they have opposite charges. And so thermal equilibrium then has a net charge. And so what happens in physical systems is, let's say you apply a chemical potential, let's say to electromagnetic charge, what happens is it draws in electrons from the outside. And so then you reach thermal equilibrium only because there's a surrounding bath. Your system itself has net charge Q, and the bath surrounding it has net charge minus Q. And so the universe obviously has no external bath. And so to reach thermal equilibrium, they just posited a B minus L breaking interaction, which lets you reach thermal equilibrium. OK, and so sort of the unifying theme for all these physics, all these approaches are basically new physics. The basic reason why, there are a bunch of ways, but the standard way is you really need to break this accidental B minus L symmetry that the standard model has in order to generate a net B minus L asymmetry. And the one method that might not have needed new physics was the electroweak baryogenesis. And it turns out with a measured value of the Higgs mass, this doesn't work. And so it's actually not entirely true. This statement that the standard model has an accidental B minus L symmetry and needs to be broken is not true, because we actually know that there exists a force that breaks B minus L. Namely, we know that gravity, in fact, breaks your B minus L global symmetry.
Oh, we don't know that.
Okay, so there are two statements to this. One is I'm going to give a brief argument, which I think is rather convincing that it does. And two, it's actually an anomalous symmetry. The U1 graviton squared is non-zero. And so if you actually take, in the context of gravity, the derivative of J mu B plus or B minus L is proportional to R tilde. And so Witten actually did this computation and showed that so that the U1 B minus L is in an anomalous symmetry under gravity. And aside from that, there are also other considerations that I'm going to review here that suggest that it's even non-anomalous symmetries are probably broken by gravity.
I don't quite see that. The triangle line with the sum of charges of B minus L, does it not vanish?
Yeah, it does not vanish. It does not vanish, yeah. This is why for a lot of theories of, like, when you try to gauge things like B minus L, you need to add in additional matter to cancel anomalies. Because the U1, if you just take the sum of U1 charges, it doesn't vanish.
right-handed neutrinos?
I think if you add in right-handed neutrinos,
yeah,
it'll vanish.
Okay.
But like, if you add in right-handed neutrinos,
yeah.
So you could just say it's a
really mild addition, right?
Yeah, it's a mild addition, but that's why I'm going to try to. I think it's more convincing just to try to argue that gravity does not allow for global symmetries, just in general. And so I'm going to actually give a brief argument, basically review the standard argument for why gravity shouldn't have global symmetries. So like the 2 or 3 line argument is, let's say we take a black hole, create a black hole out of neutrinos. The no-hare theorem says that black holes in 4 dimensions are described by spin and their electromagnetic charge and nothing else. In particular, this black hole forgets that it was created out of a state that was originally had lepton number and evaporates thermally, and so that you have destroyed your lepton number. Further evidence is basically every known example of quantum gravity we know of happens to not have any global symmetries. But let's go through this example here of creating a black hole out of neutrinos in more detail. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that gravity preserves B minus L and derive a contradiction. So the first step is you take a bunch of neutrinos at rest, and then let's just say, to make it dynamical, take one neutrino here and just put it barely outside of the Schwarzschild radius, and then so when you let it evolve dynamically, it falls in, creates a black hole. So this initial state has like 1, 2, 3, 4, is it? 14 lepton number. So you let it fall in, it creates a black hole. The black hole, you can either say it decays or it's stable. Stable black holes are actually experimentally ruled out. The way you can see this is that if there were stable black holes, that means there'd be stable black holes with arbitrary B minus L charge. And this is bad because this is an infinite many number of black holes. And so, so for example, a thermodynamic nightmare. The sun is a thermodynamic system. It would fluctuate into Planck-scale remnants. And so that's one problem. Another thing is the renormalized Planck mass would go to 0. You can also say that we know that when we're in an accelerating reference frame, Rindler space has a temperature. And if there are an infinite number of particles, even if they're heavy, this means there'd be an infinite many particles in your space. And when I'm running around, I don't see any an infinite number of particles appear. So
you know, all those arguments are the same. You could have said about the Ewing catastrophe in classical mechanics with a black body radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the solution was not that that those things don't exist.
Yeah.
It's quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I don't quite buy those arguments.
Okay. So I think I can argue, though, that definitely if black holes decay, that there is a problem.
Okay.
So the reason why, so if black holes decay, then in addition to any other radiation, it has to give back those 14 neutrinos that I constructed the black hole out of, right? Because the lightest particle carrying B minus L charge are the neutrinos. And so it should, you have 14 of them. So if they decay, you have this situation where you have your 14 neutrinos creating a black hole. It radiates, evaporates, so you get these 14 neutrinos back plus anything else. Now, this actually has a problem. Namely, it doesn't conserve energy. So if you look at this original state, you have 14 neutrinos at rest. So you have 14 times the mass of the neutrino plus any potential energy. Now over here, you just look at the neutrinos and not any additional stuff. And you'll notice you have your 14 mass of the neutrino, but then the potential energy is now completely different. You've taken these guys and separated them very far. And so it takes energy to go from this original situation to go to this guy. And so this assumption that the black hole has decayed means that you just violate energy conservation.
Sorry, why can that not be a gravitational energy?
Well, just calculate the gravitational potential energy here.
Yeah, that's very negative.
It's very negative here and a lot less negative here. So the difference is you've gained energy.
Why can't it just decay to a number of, you drew a picture that Lyon had done a concern energy.
Yeah.
But you couldn't have drawn a picture that didn't conserve energy where you came back to just a pretty dense cloud of neutrinos that were, gravitationally basically close to boundary.
Yeah, that's sort of. Yeah, that's sort of why. Well, if you try not to add in additional photons just because it gives energy, but let's just say all of these guys were on top of each other except for one guy, which was infinitesimally away from the Schwarzschild radius, right?
You sort of. I think you're sort of committing the logical fallacy that on the left hand side, the neutrino is. Quartic neutrinos obviously have a mass less than it.
Yeah.
But there's many initial states. I mean, I guess there's fewer than the black hole
it's
dealing with, but there's many states of N neutrinos with that energy. Mm-hmm. Right? You can perturb that energy in a lot of
different ways. And so what you want to say is that the black hole decays not very slowly, but very quickly, where it just suddenly emits 14 guys that are barely around here and then recollapses very quickly into a black hole again? Or
it doesn't necessarily recollapse, right?
Well, I mean, it sort of has, why wouldn't it recollapse if basically it was epsilonically away from being a black hole originally?
So you
basically have no energy. You have no energy in your system. And so it has nowhere to go except for a black hole state. And so, I mean, you could sort of imagine that it sort of emits a neutrino, which falls right back in, emits a neutrino, which falls right back in,
yeah.
Which I would say is the black hole is sort of stable rather than unstable. But,
okay,
and.
But if you're saying it's dynamical, you're saying you're actually putting in a little bit more energy than it takes to put it to produce a black hole.
Yeah, I mean, you could also just say, let's just start with the situation where it's just a black hole with 14 B minus L charge and mass equal to 14 times the mass of the left neutrinos. And then it, because of gravitational energy, it really is impossible to go into the 14 neutrinos. Right, because if you're saying you could just start with the black hole.
Look,
and then get rid of all of these.
Unless there's an entropy overshoot, which you're not making, this process is fairly reversible, right? And you've described it as a reversible process.
Well, yes, but I also don't have a theory that describes this right now. We're just talking about a process, right? I can describe a process that violates energy. Doesn't mean that it actually happens. I am not quite sure.
Anyway,
but yeah, let's just, I guess, say for now that black hole evaporation breaks B minus L. You can say this, I mean, you can also just say that the standard model, the U1 B minus L, has a gravitational anomaly. And so you don't expect things, coherent excitations to preserve B minus L. Yeah, well, I mean,
none of these arguments, that
wouldn't go about. Yeah, for discrete groups, you can just say that they're gauged discrete groups, and then there are good symmetries of gravity. Yeah. So I mean, I guess the simplest argument might just be, say, standard model U1 B minus L has a gravitational anomaly, and thus should not be preserved by black hole evaporation. Just because the black hole evaporation, the black holes are coherent excitations of the G mu nu, and so just like coherent excitations of in the electroweak gauge theory break B plus L, you would expect this to break B minus L. And so If you take that gravity breaks in particular black hole evaporation breaks B minus L, then any one of us could actually do baryogenesis. We just take baryons or antibaryons and toss them into a black hole. It evaporates thermally, and then it's destroyed by the black hole. And so sort of the standard model plus a black hole contains all the everything you need to do baryogenesis. Of course, so what people have talked about before has generally been we need black holes destroying baryon B minus L rather than generating it. And so we're going to need a different mechanism to actually generate it rather than destroy it. And to arrive at that, let's look at sort of a calculable toy example first before going to black holes. We're just going to consider neutrino mass generation via seesaw. Just add in a right-handed neutrino, make it very heavy. And then you say the right-handed neutrino, it breaks lepton number, but it decays symmetrically. In particular, it decays to W plus and L minus and W minus and L plus with equal probability. And then you might, okay, so now you have, so this is very similar to black holes in the sense that it can be created asymmetrically, but decays symmetrically. And so the ways we know of to make these decays asymmetric is you can add in C and CP violating couplings, then loop level diagrams will cause you to generate an asymmetry between these two processes. However, in the case of black holes, we don't really have an explicit coupling. So let's think of another way. And so the other way is, well, when calculating decay width, you integrate over phase space and you multiply by the matrix element squared. So you could change the phase space, in particular the kinematics between these two states. And so normally this is people don't think about this because particles and antiparticles have the same energy levels. However, if you introduce a chemical potential, this will increase the energy of, let's say, the antiparticle state here with the lepton, anti-lepton, as compared to the energy level with the lepton. In particular, if you make the chemical potential larger than the mass of the right-handed neutrino, one of these guys is kinematically forbidden by energy conservation. And so you can make this decay completely 100% asymmetric if the chemical potential is large enough. So since chemical potentials will take symmetric decays and make them asymmetric, what about the case of the black holes? So what black holes do is they can emit, by the same picture, either emit a neutrino, become a smaller black hole, or emit an antineutrino, become a smaller black hole. And normally the calculation is, well, this happens with, they happen at the same rate with the Hawking temperature. However, once there's a chemical potential, if the black hole evaporation is still thermal, then as I mentioned before, thermal radiation in the presence of a chemical potential carries charge because for one thing, you have to fill up the Fermi C.
Easiest way of implementing what you're just saying is, for example, to have a huge mass of neutrinos, so there is a Pauli pressure against the gain of neutrinos, so you prefer to go plant neutrinos.
Yeah. And so, for example, that happens, that exact example actually happens in like supernova where there's a very high density of neutrinos. And so the chemical potential for neutrinos and antineutrinos sets it so that the decays go through one way and not the other. Okay. And so sort of the whole thing is then just, if we say B minus L is, at least in the standard model, is broken by quantum gravity. And so we don't need to add new physics as long as we include gravity. Black holes have a temperature and thermal systems carry charge if there's a chemical potential. And so in particular, the black hole temperature, the evaporation of a black hole, will generate an asymmetry as long as there is a chemical potential. And
but I'm not to understand what is generating the chemical potential in this case?
Okay, so I'll get around to that because chemical, there's a reason why people don't think about chemical potentials usually. It's because they break CPT. And so because they split the energy levels of particles versus antiparticles. And so what I'm going to do is say the following. So the expansion of the universe breaks time translation invariance. Mm-hmm. I'm going to combine this expansion of the universe with a CP violating coupling so that I get a chemical potential that's proportional to the Hubble expansion of the universe. And so there's a dynamical breaking of CPT that's due to the expansion of the universe and CP violating couplings. And so if
your argument requires any breaking of the amount of cell. I mean,
okay, so
the asymmetry is generating from the fluid to generate chemical potential. So where does the breaking of the amount of cell by gravity come in?
Okay, it comes about from the fact that if you actually look at the original case here, this sort of toy example, if let's say lepton number was a good symmetry, then by adding a chemical potential, you don't change the kinematics because you increase the energy of one side by mu times the q, mu times q, and you also increase it on the other side of mu times by mu times q. And so all energy differences stay the same. It's only when there's two processes that have different q in the final states that when you turn on the chemical potential that you cause a splitting. And so equivalently, there's actually a good analogy with charged black holes. So charged black holes emit asymmetrically, but what happens for charged black holes, charged black holes also emit asymmetrically because they have a chemical potential, but charged black holes will emit more, let's say, electrons than positrons. But in this process, it also depletes the charge of the black hole itself. And so it only emits exactly the amount of charge it originally had. And so it's really the reason why the B minus L violation comes into fact is the statement that the black holes are the sort of no-hair theorem saying that black holes cannot be characterized by a B minus L charge. Let's see, where was I? So there are many ways to sort of try to interpret this. Every interpretation of Hawking radiation sort of has its flaws, so I'm just going to be very brief about this. One way to think about this is sort of go back to the laboratory experiment where you say if you have a chemical potential, you draw a charge from the outside bath. And here, because you can't see past the boundary of the black hole, you can sort of imagine the black hole as the thermal bath to our universe. That's one way to think about it. Another way you can try to think about things is that you have Schwinger pair production at the event horizon, and particles fall in more than antiparticles because of energetic concerns. And then because you can't see behind the horizon, you never see all the accumulation of antiparticles there.
Answer.
Yeah.
Sorry, so is this basically the same as spontaneous barrier analysis, but instead of having explicit B minus L violating interaction, you have the black hole?
Yeah. Yep. It's just using quantum gravity to source the B minus L violation rather than an explicit new physics. Okay. So now I'm going to go on to the ingredients in particular.
I don't understand what is your chemical potential.
I'm literally about to go about how I get this chemical potential. Okay, so both gravity and inflation describe our universe very well. So what we really need is the standard model to be augmented by dynamical gravity and an inflaton. And since, at least as an effective theorist myself, that means we just write down all 1 over n Planck operators included, allowed by symmetry. And so the neatest case is when you look at the inflaton. So you look at gravity plus, so the inflaton, in order to have a really flat potential, typically has a shift symmetry, which means when writing down higher dimensional operators that connect the inflaton to the standard model, it needs to be proportional to the derivative of the inflaton. And so then literally the leading operator you can write to the standard model is the derivative of the inputon coupled to some current. Now,
but isn't this just phi coupled to R squared?
You mean RR dual or?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but when you mean when you integrate by parts to get that, yeah. But then it's easier to understand as this because phi is a time-dependent object during inflation. And so at least for me, I like having a Lagrangian that's not time-dependent. And so during inflation, phi dot is non-zero. In fact, it's proportional to Hubble times M Planck. And so this actually change is exactly a chemical potential. The reason why being once phi dot is non-zero, that means you have some constant times J0. J0 is a charge, right? The J0 is the number density, charge density. And so you are literally changing your Lagrangian by mu times Q. So at least for the standard shift symmetric inflaton, literally the first thing you can write connecting it to the standard model is the chemical potential. And it's non-zero during inflation. So if you're not a huge fan of inflation, then you can just say, well, let's just look at gravity. And so next you can write another coupling. So this is not the first operator you would write down, coupling Planck, like gravitational dynamics, but it's one of the first ones. And again here, the expansion of the universe means that the derivative, time derivative of the Ricci scalar is non-zero. In particular, it's proportional to Hubble cubed. And so you end up having a chemical potential that's, again, proportional to the expansion of the universe. And so it's really the combination of the expansion of the universe plus this coupling, which is CP violating, that causes the CPT violation needed to get a chemical potential.
So is that the V there is the agreement state?
Yeah.
So, we
wouldn't get
this.
So yeah. So,
like, did it say it's a horizon instead of a black hole horizon?
Yeah. So what happens here, at least for this case, during inflation or de Sitter space, this vanishes. It just sort of, I guess, just you have to write down a higher dimension, a different operator to generate it during inflation. And also, it vanishes during radiation domination, where W is 1/3. And so, this actually happens to be non-zero only during matter domination.
Because I was just thinking if this is something you could do without having black holes, just with the radiation to the horizon.
Yeah, okay, so, yeah, so...
But then you couldn't get the same potential.
Yeah. You'd have to write a different one, but I guess you could just write the previous one here with the inflaton and say that's the reason why you're in de Sitter space. And so using that same argument, you can say, well, a guy sitting in a static patch of the Sitter space would see asymmetric radiation. And then, so what's, however, here, because I'm sort of looking to try to explain the current asymmetry, you have to look at actually matching that picture onto post-inflation, where you actually see everything. And so when you do that carefully, you actually find that that asymmetry vanishes. And so it's sort of a quirk of particles, and hence the asymmetry here being a frame-dependent question. And so if you took that particular frame of the static frame, then after inflation, that guy sees a very sharp acceleration when the universe stops, and that happens to exactly result in the cancellation of all the asymmetry. Equivalently, you can look at the following statement, which is if you just say you had Minkowski space, exponential growth Minkowski space, and then you have a conformally coupled scalar. Because it's conformally coupled, if you start off with no radiation, at the end you also have no radiation. So despite the fact that in the process you see static patches with a finite temperature and finite number density for this particle, it turns out to be vanish once inflation ends. Yep.
But you're not assuming that the baryogenesis actually takes place during.
Yeah. I'm just sort of, I mean, this doesn't even really need to be the inflaton. This could be like an axion afterwards where it's just slowly rolling or something. Any field that has non-zero time derivative works.
Well, but, I mean, if phi dot squared is Hubble out of the box,
Yeah, so that's sort of, yeah, that's sort of, it's sort of nice if this is the, happens to be the inflaton, just because it gives something that's pretty large.
But if that is the inflaton, I don't really expect that, because it only works very,
yeah,
depends on the potential, obviously.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so that's, this is sort of why in my outline I had two sections of during inflation and after inflation. And there you basically trade off two things. Here, because this is proportional to HM Planck, you have a coupling that's about 10 orders of magnitude larger than this guy here, which is proportional to H cubed over M Planck. But of course, during inflation, it's rough, well, it is exponentially harder to do anything. And so you're sort of just trading off.
But even in the better example, how can this possibly ever work? I mean, you always will have a suppression of roughly the mass of the particles of carry the breath of M Planck or M star, right?
Yeah, so let's just set that M Planck.
The
rate
is always a lot smaller than Hubble. The expansion rate.
So here you can actually, so for the inflaton, that's, let's just say that M star is like some M Planck, some Planck suppressed operator. That means this is literally, the chemical potential is literally just H up to some numerical factor up front. And so there you don't have a strong suppression at all, which is why this.
J carries units as well.
Dimension, it's 3.
Yeah.
And so the chemical potential has dimension 1.
Right.
And so you just, it's by dimensional analysis, it's proportional to the Hubble.
But don't you get the mass of the particle that carries the charge somewhere?
Actually, let me calculate the energy spectrum in the presence of a chemical potential, just to be clear. So that's this next slide here. And so one way to understand chemical potentials is that they couple. So what else couples to J mu? A gauge field. It couples A mu, J mu. In particular, you can pretend that chemical potentials are an A0 equals constant. And so here I just wrote down a scalar field with pretending A0 is a constant, which is mu. And so this is how a chemical potential acts on a free scalar field. And you notice that it's basically just multiplying the field by e to the I mu t. And so this means that when you decompose this guy into creation and annihilation operators, you'll notice that you multiply by e to the I mu t. And here you also multiply by e to the I mu t. But notice that particles have their energy increased by a unit mu, and antiparticles have their energy decreased by mu. And so this energy is the standard square root of p squared plus m squared by looking at equations of motion. And so this is in detail how sort of a chemical potential messes with the energy levels of particles versus antiparticles. And so, yeah, so the mass of a particle only comes in when calculating the energy here, and when you're, this sort of square root of p squared plus m squared, when calculating the total energy, you take that and you add or subtract mu. This is also, for example, why you see when you do any thermodynamic calculation, you always see the combination E plus or minus mu, and it's not inside the square root of p squared plus m squared. Okay. So one thing I did that I haven't proven to you yet was that black holes remain thermal in the presence of a chemical potential. And so the easiest way to do this is to just do sort of the Gibbons-Hawking way of proving things, which is you take your geometry, you analytically continue it to Euclidean space, and you say, I want a well-defined geometry with no deficit angles. And then it turns out time is forced to be periodic with exactly the Hawking temperature. And so this works for every single example we know of. But notice also that this derivation made absolutely no reference of matter content or chemical potentials, meaning that this shows that black holes are thermal regardless of what your theory is, what your matter content you toss in, or whether or not these things have chemical potentials. So this shows that the theory is thermal, and even if you explicitly add in a chemical potential. And in fact, this is not something new. This is exactly what happens in charged black holes. So for charged black holes, what you do is you take the geometry, again, you turn it, analytically continue it into Euclidean space-time, and you ask this is no deficit angle. But then you say, okay, now that's good. Now you look at the Hawking radiation with some temperature, but you notice that there's actually a chemical potential. The reason for this is, as I mentioned before, gauge fields couples as A mu J mu, and an electrically charged black hole has A0 non-zero. In fact, it's equal to the potential, which is just Q over R. And so what you find is that for charged black holes, their Hawking radiation is the standard derivation, and the particles are emitted with a chemical potential equal to just Q over R at the evaluated at the horizon. And so...
And your inflaton is playing the long-range form.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is just the case where there's an explicit chemical potential added by some other term in the Lagrangian, not sourced by your gauge field. And yeah, so again, this is not new. Hawking actually derived this in his very first paper where he derived Hawking radiation. So let's look at very quickly at the evaporation of black holes. It's pretty easy to just calculate what's the number density of particles, subtract it from number density of antiparticles. Because they have different chemical potentials, you get a rather simple expression here. This mu cubed term is just the standard. I did this for fermions. But mu cubed is the fact that when there's no temperature, what you're doing is you're just filling up the Fermi C until the Fermi momentum is equal to the chemical potential. And then this extra term is just the effect of turning on a temperature. And so the case I'm going to be looking at, basically the chemical potentials are small compared to the black hole temperatures. And so I'm just going to be focusing in on the second term as much larger.
Sorry, can I just ask a stupid question? It goes back a little bit to what Isha was asking. So if you just take W5 times W, suppose I was working in a theory where I added particle content for the gravitational modeling error.
Yeah.
Then I can use integration by parts to just turn that into a 5W J mu.
Yeah.
Which at the operator level should vanish.
Yeah. And so then you have to start
some whatever explicit quantum gravity break.
Yeah.
You want to
that's right. And so
bothers me that that would be the case, sort of neglecting breaking that you have to put in explicitly or the anomaly breaking.
Yeah.
It bothers me that you're doing a different calculation a different way, and you don't see the need to put in either the anomaly or the anomaly.
Yeah. So the reason why is also that same argument goes for every theory, any other theory, and still it's sort of the standard folk theorem that gravity does not preserve global symmetries because Hawking evaporation is thermal. And so even then we have no operator understanding of why we think, like even at that level we have no like equations really associated to why we believe that gravity breaks global symmetries. We just have this sort of notion that, well, if you create black holes out of some global charge, no hair theorem says that it forgets it had global charge and evaporates away. And so since that's the sort of level of the argument which we use to say that gravity can destroy global charges, I'm sort of using that exact same argument to just say, turn it on its head and use it to generate global symmetries instead.
No, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
If you integrated by parts first, it is very explicit where you would have to put in the weight
of
that hand waving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see where as clearly where you put it in if you don't integrate by parts. So I guess that's what I'm asking. If you don't integrate by parts, but you just couple five off to J, where are you additionally invoking the statement that gravity breaks?
Yeah, so that's the statement that the baryons, the black holes, when it emits more neutrinos or B minus L than anti-B minus L, it doesn't sort of remember that it itself carries
the
opposite.
If it wasn't true, the black hole itself will also have a slightly higher, like the black hole itself will also have a chemical potential.
Yeah, the black hole itself would carry B minus L charge.
Okay.
And at least, for example, in the context of the standard model, we know that there are no black hole solutions that carry B minus L, just because, for example, there's no scalars that carry B minus L charge. So even, well, we think it's not true that four-dimensional black holes carry any scalar charge, but even if it did, it wouldn't be able to. It'd have to carry sort of fermionic charge if it wanted to carry B minus L charge. And so it's sort of two extra steps beyond what we believe possible in order for the black hole to remember that it has B minus L charge.
I'm happy to fix
yeah.
that. It's still not, it seems like.
Yeah, I guess is the statement that the black hole has no charge, that I'm not counting the charge of the black hole.
I'm willing to accept that statement.
Yeah.
I am just a little more confused about exactly where.
Okay, so let's describe what happens if you added a chemical potential for electric charge.
Okay.
So what happens for that is you radiate off asymmetrically, but because your radiating charge is conserved, the charge of the black hole is its original charge minus whatever the Hawking radiation charge is. And so as a result, when this whole process is over, you have some black hole with some charge that's equal and opposite, or that when added to the charge of the Hawking radiation gives you your original starting charge. And so charge wasn't violated. And so because in that.
I'm gonna ask a question differently about why. So you should keep
going. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So this chemical transfer is very important in the phi field. The phi field is very close to the boundary.
Yeah.
But then there'd be a back reaction from the black hole to the profile of the phi field.
Yeah, so I'm making the simplifying assumption right now that the chemical potential is constant throughout space.
But you assume that the temperature is much higher than the chemical potential.
Yeah. Yeah, so you might worry that that's the case.
But what you care about, will destroy your assumptions of the gradients of pi are zero.
Yeah.
But it won't necessarily destroy your assumptions that the time derivative of pi is non-zero.
Yeah.
But he really cares about the kind of potential in time derivative of pi.
Yeah. And so you'd have, if the black hole and its radiation somehow back reacted on the potential of the scalar, then yes, it could change the time derivative. I'm sort of assuming that that's a small effect. Yeah.
Your black hole radiates a lot of phi
field. No, you could just make the phi field heavier than the mass, the temperature, right?
But then, will you lose your slow?
No, you don't. Like one way, you could, like the standard way, you could make the mass of the particle extremely heavy, and then.
Then you will lose your slow. If you make the particle extremely heavy, you will lose the slow.
No. It's an issue of where the field value is, not what the mass is necessarily. But yeah, it is possible. But again, it's also an assumption, a simplifying assumption I'm making, that that this chemical potential is constant through space. Okay, so yeah. So in thermal equilibrium, you can calculate what the asymmetry is. And then this means you can actually calculate what the charge asymmetry radiated by the black hole is. You just take 4 pi r squared, multiply it by this, and then up to a factor of 4, you just get what the standard radiation emitted by the black hole is. And in the limit where the chemical potential is small, it turns out that the charge radiated by the black hole is constant, or rather independent of the mass of the black hole, which is an amusing coincidence. And this means you can basically just calculate what the total mass or total charge emitted by the black hole is by multiplying by the evaporation time. And so at that point, it does larger black holes live longer, and so produce longer, more B minus L charge. Okay, so finally, I'm just gonna sort of go through pedagogically. I'm gonna go through this fairly quickly since it's conceptually less interesting. It's just, let's apply this to various cosmological scenarios and see how easy or hard is it to reproduce the observed 10 to the minus 10 baryon number asymmetry. The end result is that it's gonna actually be a little difficult, and I'm not actually gonna talk much about the source of the black holes, but just some standard stories for how to create black holes. So after inflation, you can have small density perturbations and just gravitational attraction give you black holes. A lot of models of inflation, for example, hybrid inflation, produce large density perturbations as you transition from various phases. And when these large density perturbations enter the horizon, this just takes everything in your horizon and scrunches it into a black hole, sort of a large density perturbation. During inflation, it's actually extremely difficult to produce them. Some ways you can imagine is sort of the models where you have periodic ring collisions that you might be producing black holes then. You might say that there's a warm inflation type model where the inflaton somehow gives you black holes and it's decays. And it's actually a rather amusing fact that De Sitter space is unstable to decay to black holes. This rate actually turns out to be extremely small, but the way you can understand that is that De Sitter space is approximately thermal, and thermal systems all are unstable to decay into black holes, because if you eventually look at large enough radius, because there's constant energy density, eventually you'll see a black hole. So that's that. So after inflation, there's basically only one source of chemical potential, and so that's the coupling with the Ricci scalar. This chemical potential is small during radiation domination. It's not identically zero because at loop level, the gauge coupling runs, and so you can actually calculate that W is not exactly 1/3, but deviates slightly. And for the standard model, it's really small. It's a part in 1,000. And so I'm going to be looking at the case where the universe is matter dominated rather than radiation dominated. So you can either basically assume two things. The black holes are small. Their energy density is small compared to the rest of the universe, or they're large compared to the rest of the universe. So let's first assume that they're small. This is the amount of charge generated per black hole as a function of time, basically because the Hubble is proportional to 1 over t. Incidentally, that also makes this effect near impossible to observe, because it's large in the early universe when t was small, but right now it's 40 orders of magnitude smaller, and so it's extremely difficult to study today.
That's okay. There you're in company with every
other
small. Yeah. Well, I'm a little worse.
Yeah. Actually, an amusing fact is if the chemical potential is large compared to the Hawking temperature, that what's being emitted by the black hole is independent of the Hawking temperature. It's this first term here, that even if the temperature, for example, of the black hole is zero, even if it's a maximally charged black hole with zero temperature, it still radiates proportional to U cubed. And so this is, for example, why these maximal black holes in the standard model are unstable, because even though they have zero temperature, they still emit charge. And in fact, they emit it extremely quickly because E and M is much stronger force than gravity. Let's just go through this quickly. If you just assume that there's some number density of black holes in the early universe, you can calculate what its abundance is. there's a simple differential equation governing how the abundance of black holes turns into the abundance of B minus L asymmetry. You can solve this exactly. It's simplest if you assume that the black holes still decay while the universe is matter dominated. And so you obtain a very simple expression. You can sort of plot this guy and see basically that you need couplings here, which I denoted by lambda epsilon. Even to get, you really want your black hole to be much larger than M Planck. But in order to start getting black holes with masses much larger than M Planck, to reproduce 10 to the minus 10, you need very large couplings. So the moral of the story for this is essentially you either need very large couplings, which basically means suppressions that are not 1 over the Planck scale, or you need small black holes, and somehow Hawking's calculation needs to still be valid at small black holes. For black holes which dominate the energy density of the universe, there is a standard story. What you do is you just say they keep on expanding away until the Hubble is roughly equal to the decay rate. Then they all decay. And so you actually know what the number density of the black holes is, because it's when the decay rate is equal to the Hubble. And from this, you can just, it's a simple calculation to calculate what the reheat temperature is, what the entropy is, and thus what the B minus L asymmetry is. And what you get is basically 10 to the minus 8 times, basically you see it's pretty obvious that once the mass of the black hole is much larger than M Planck, this is going to be an extremely small number. So the coupling with the Ricci scalar is essentially you get this following situation, which is you either need this suppression there to be not 1 over M Planck squared, but in fact something like 1 over M gut or smaller. Or you need very small Planck scale black holes. So now during inflation, you have this other coupling here, which is 10 orders of magnitude larger, but it's also equivalently that much more difficult to generate black holes and keep them during inflation because they just get inflated away. But regardless, let's just go through this. It's as pedagogically, you just assume that the black holes are being produced at some constant rate. And then you can just solve for what the equilibrium black hole number density is, and hence what the equilibrium B minus L density is. And then after reheating, you can divide by the entropy and calculate what the abundance of it is. And numerically, you can just look at this. We'll be going through the rest quickly. That essentially no large numbers are really needed. But of course, it's hard to get a non-small number of black holes being produced. So you've traded one hard problem for another.
The line that we have to be on to
get 10 to the minus 10.
So that's reheat
temperature versus basically the suppression scale divided by the rate at which black holes are being produced.
So what's a good place to be on that line?
So a good place to be is, So a nice place is, let's say BICEP is correct, you have 10 to the 16. If you want perturbative couplings of the inflaton, that means the reheat temperature is a factor of G smaller, so you might want to look at around, let's say, 10 to the 13. And so there you would need a suppression scale of about 10 to the 14. Oh, this is not very visible on the screen, sorry. So that's not too small. And you could just also imagine M star in this case is at the same scale of Hubble and the potential. And so that's going to be around like 10 to the 15-ish. And so that's not too bad. because this is a coupling of the inflaton to the standard model. So you'd say it's 1 over the energy scale of the inflaton dynamics. Quick note, we're considering small black holes. It's an amusing fact that black holes in De Sitter space behave strangely. For example, Busso and Hawking showed that black holes can anti-evaporate when they're in De Sitter space. But random curiosities. So let's conclude. So sort of the leading order terms connecting the standard model and gravity or the inflaton are really chemical potentials. And because of the expansion of the universe, these guys turn into chemical potentials. And you can obtain baryogenesis by using the fact that sort of black holes break global symmetries because they act thermally, and use the chemical potential to sort of extract V minus L charge from black holes. And so this sort of is nice because you didn't have to introduce any new physics. And so some future directions being basically, are there other fields that could act as the chemical potential to help get around this problem that you need large couplings? Or I guess you could also just say that your suppression scale is smaller and so you're integrating out scalars at some other scale. It'd be nice to understand, I made the simplifying assumption that the chemical potentials were constant. And so it'd be nice to sort of double check that. And so finally, it'd be nice if there was some sort of observational consequence, because this effect is proportional to Hubble. Hubble is much smaller today than it is in the past. And so it would be nice if you could somehow test this idea. Okay, and I think that's it.
Yeah. Maybe this is stupid, but the claim that this effect is proportional to Hubble depends on the assumption that this is maybe coming from inflation, or that you're dealing with some sort of isotropic and homogeneous space, and that's the most natural thing.
Yeah.
But if you're dealing with black holes that are produced in density fluctuations anyway,
yeah,
then these could be living in regions where the effect of expansion rate is very different.
Yeah.
So could that
that's
be
right.
something that beats up the effect?
It's something that's extremely difficult to calculate. And so that's why I sort of made the simplifying assumption that you just sort of take it constant with respect to space.
Because living in like a very rapidly collapsing region.
Yeah. This is an effect that requires time violation. And so expansion of the universe or the fact that you're actually creating these black holes dynamically could also very easily since the timescales at which the black holes are produced by, let's say, large density fluctuations is very quick, right? And so that's a very larger time violation than Hubble. And so you could think that it's possibly that. Yeah.
So you know, second time, so with the chemical potentials generated by the Rydberg scale, the partial mu r, is that divergence at the singularity of the
black? Yeah, so it should be calculated at the horizon of the black hole.
I'm not very sure. I don't know.
And so in the case, let's say that the black hole energy density is small, that means there's a lot of particles floating around, and I'm assuming that there's also a lot of particles at the event horizon of the black hole, which is, at least to me, seems like a reasonable assumption.
I don't know how to describe the inside of that. So you can show that this impact is negative.
Well, you don't need to calculate the inside of a black hole to see this. You need just like at the horizon, right?
You're sure that this doesn't give you any impact. So it's not sensitive.
No, the singularity is at the sort of r equals zero, not r equals the black hole. So
it doesn't show you any impact. Because this in that region this term is divergent. It's divergent.
Well, it's not divergent, right? So if you're looking at the derivative of the Ricci scalar,
yes,
this is proportional to let's say Hubble cubed, And at the horizon of the black hole, if it's a black hole surrounded by a thermal bath, then even at the horizon of the black hole, there's going to be a lot of particles floating around. And so it's going to be still like h squared equals v over m Planck squared.
I mean, the singularity does nothing for the radiation, even
when it's... Well, it does, right? It has a gravitational effect, so there's going to be a higher density of particles near the horizon than there are outside. Or that's not 100%. I'm not 100% sure that's correct, but it'll be different. But yeah. I mean, like I said, I made a simplifying assumption, which is that the chemical potential is constant throughout all space. It basically allows you to calculate things a lot easier.
All right, so that's my question.